In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Good evening to all of you. Thanks for coming here tonight. As Dariush mentioned, the topic of the lecture tonight is Islam and justice. What does Islam teach about justice in general? As you know, justice is a human ideal. Since the dawn of civilization, humanity has been thinking about this very vital virtue. And we have had a lot of heroes in history whose actions and movements have revolved around the notion of justice, particularly social justice. Justice is not restricted to Islam as a religion per se. Almost every single religion, particularly within the Abrahamic tradition, emphasizes social justice. Tonight, I would like to share my thoughts on Islam and justice. In particular, what does Islam's holy book, the Quran, teach us about justice? What does Islam expect its followers to behave in terms of observing justice? Those of you who are familiar with Islamic theology and have read the Muslim holy book, the Quran, probably you have figured out that justice figures very prominently in the Quran. This is not to say that Muslims live by this ideal. This is not to say that Muslim governments embody justice. Far from it. Unfortunately, if you look around the world, I cannot speak of a single Islamic country out there where the social and political affairs of the state revolves around the notion of justice. Having said that, theology is obviously different than the actions of individuals and governments. Here, we're dealing purely with Islamic theology, what Islam teaches about justice. Justice is a very wide subject area. No matter what, I cannot do justice to the topic of justice in one lecture. It's impossible. What I'm going to do is this. I'm going to categorize the major teachings of Islam in three areas: justice and nature, personal justice, and social justice. As I go through the lecture and get into each subject area, I will share with you the relevant verses in the Holy Quran and the authentic Islamic sources. I will also discuss some of the major issues that as a race we humans are facing due to lack of justice in our affairs. So my lecture tonight is going to be a mix of theory and current affairs. So that's going to be basically the blueprint for tonight's lecture. And hopefully the presentation will spark some interesting questions for the Q&A session. What does Islam teach about justice? Some philosophers view justice merely as a personal virtue. It is something that nice people do. Islam definitely agrees with this narrow perspective on justice as a personal virtue. However, Islam goes way beyond justice as being a personal virtue. Justice is actually the backbone of creation as far as Islam is concerned. So this part of the lecture is fairly important. As far as Islam is concerned, justice is the backbone of creation. Imam Ali, who was the son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the first saint in the Shi'i Muslim tradition in Islam, has a lot of insights on the issue of justice. And tonight I'm going to give you a few of his major sayings on the notion of justice. Imam Ali says, "Al-adlu asasun bihi qivam al-alam." Justice is the foundation upon which the universe is erected. Justice is the foundation upon which the universe is erected. In other words, justice is built into the fabric of the universe. In the universe in which we live, justice is built into it. Let me explain a little bit what Imam Ali has in mind. You see, in the Islamic tradition, God has many beautiful names. In Islamic terminology, we call it Asma'ul Husna, God's beautiful names. Up to probably 99 beautiful names of God are mentioned in the Holy Quran. You see, God's names are different than the names we give to our children. When we name our children, we don't typically think about their characteristics, their attributes, their mentality when we name them. Hamid is a common name in Iran and across the Islamic world. Translated into English, Hamid means praiseworthy. You may name your son Hamid in praiseworthy, even though that person may end up being a common thief. So, the name has absolutely no relevance to the content of the character of the individual. God's names are not like that. God's names, in essence, capture the various aspects of God's character. Each divine name gives us a glimpse of who God really is. And guess what? One of the beautiful names of God in the Holy Quran is Al-Adil, meaning the just. One of God's beautiful names in Islam is the just. In other words, one of the faces of God in this vast universe is the face of justice. That's what Imam Ali had in mind by saying that justice is the foundation of this great universe. Some of you may be confused by now that we typically talk about justice in terms of human affairs, but here I'm talking about justice as being the foundation of the universe. Well, in reality, justice has different meanings in Islamic theology. Depending on the context, justice would mean something completely different. Within the context of creation, justice means equilibrium and balance. Within the context of creation and the universe, justice means equilibrium and balance. In other words, God's appearance as the just in the universe has led to an essential underlying balance among the various phenomena that exist. Let me give you a verse from the Holy Quran that encapsulates everything that I've said so far. Chapter 55, verses 5 through 10. The sun and the moon follow their calculated courses. The plants and the trees submit to his designs. He has raised up the sky. He has set the balance so that you may not exceed in the balance. Weigh with justice and do not fall short in the balance. Those of you who know Arabic, balance in this verse in Arabic means al-mizan. Al-mizan means balance. That's the Arabic word that is used here. Those of you who were paying attention to this verse, probably you noticed that seamlessly the Quran is tying weighing with justice. In other words, when somebody comes to your store and buys a pound of apples, you know, you put that on a scale, you balance it, right? That idea is mentioned here, weigh with justice. But seamlessly, weigh with justice is tied to balance in the universe. In other words, the way the Quran puts it, it's exactly the same system. Balance must be observed, because the foundation of this vast universe is on justice. So the heavens are sustained through balance. That's the key to survival, right? The key to survival is balance. Physical systems in our vast universe owe their existence to balance and equilibrium. If that is the case, what do you think would destroy systems, be it physical systems or social systems? What would lead to the destruction of systems? Lack of balance, right? When the system is out of balance, it can fall apart. When justice is observed, every component, every element, every member of the system is placed where it should be. It is in its proper place. Again, this is the wisdom that Imam Ali shares with us. Al-adlu yaza'u al-umura mawazi'uha. Justice positions everything in its proper place. When justice is observed, everything will be in its proper place. In other words, there is order in the cosmos because all the elements are placed where they should be. Every component, every member, every element behaves as it was designed. If I were to use a more Islamically oriented terminology, every single atom in the universe is following its destiny, right? Every element is following its destiny, taqdir in Arabic. Every element in the physical universe, that is submitting to its original plan, its original design. Every atom is a Muslim. Every atom in the physical universe is a Muslim because it submits to the original design that God has had for it. Well, I guess if you agree with the gist of what I've said so far, you would agree that what holds this vast universe together is equilibrium and balance. However, the balance, both in the physical systems as well as in our ecosystems, are extremely delicate. The balance can be tipped very easily. Things can go out of whack very easily. Rumi, who is probably the greatest Muslim mystic who ever lived, picked on this Islamic concept of justice in the heavens and said the following in a beautiful poem. اگر یک ذره را برگیری از جای همه عالم فرو ریزد سراپای. If you displace a single atom, the entire universe will fall apart. If you displace a single atom, the entire universe is going to fall apart. Now imagine what Rumi would say if he had lived long enough to see what we have done to nature, the wholesome manipulation of nature we have done over the past few centuries. And frankly speaking, we have done really grave injustice to nature. You see, this poem by Rumi captures the essence of the religious worldview. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism. Their perspective is the following when it comes to the universe. The overall state of the natural world is right. This is a very important concept I'm talking about here. The overall state of the universe is essentially right. It is proper. It is just. If this is true, then what would be the primary goal of human reason? The goal for human reason is to understand this order. Not to manipulate, but simply to understand and to learn. This was the general perspective that humanity had with regard to nature for thousands and thousands of years. In other words, according to the religious worldview which dominated the ancient times or the pre-modern world, rather than changing the world to suit human needs, it is really our job to change our attitude so that we can live in peace and harmony with nature. See, that is the ancient worldview. That is essentially the religious perspective. That's why for thousands and thousands of years, human beings lived on this planet in relatively peaceful coexistence with nature. Something happened about 300-400 years ago. A phenomenon called modernity emerged in Europe back in the 1600s. You see, modernity fundamentally altered our view of nature and our relationship with nature. Modern reason, as opposed to pre-modern or ancient reason, is not content with understanding nature. It is not content with learning about the laws of nature. The goal of modern reason is to change nature, to manipulate nature, to conquer nature. It was the modern perspective that basically said the destiny of the human race is to conquer nature, right? So that's the blueprint for human action in the modern world. In other words, in the modern world view, there is no preordained destiny in nature and the universe. There is no built-in logic. We never talk about the state of affairs in nature being just, right, or proper. Anything can go. Anything goes as far as our relationship with nature is concerned. In other words, the task of modern reason is to conquer nature, to shape the nature on the image of humanity, to change nature to be in line with human designs, with human desires and wishes. In other words, modern reason is playing the same role that God had in pre-modern times. Exactly the same concept here. Now, this grand modern project has been in place for the past 300 years or so. But for the very first time, we are beginning to fully realize the consequences of our shift of attitude towards nature. I guess we can all agree that our attempt to conquer nature has laid waste to much of this planet. And let me be very blunt here. Environmental degradation is a consequence of human injustice towards nature. That's what, you know, I was trying to get at. The environmental crises we are facing, with no exception, in one way or another, is the result of human injustice towards nature. Human abusive practices have created environmental crises. Modern civilization seems to be at war with nature. There are certain aspects to modern thinking and modern perspective that really impacts nature negatively. Let me give you some of those negative traits in modern thinking that impacts nature. Rampant materialism, consumerism, disposable everything. These all lead to environmental crises, obviously. Even more so is arrogance that is built in to modern attitudes and modern thinking. See, modern folks think that they know it all. They think that somehow they have a right to do whatever they damn please with nature. It is our territory. See, that is the shift that happened in the 1600s in Europe, and by default now it's going around the world and becoming the accepted viewpoint. Let me share with you some of the major environmental issues that we are facing these days, which are directly tied to human abuse, because we are not observing justice with regard to nature. Global warming, obviously, is the most immediate environmental problem we're facing. Thanks to the efforts of folks such as the former Vice President Al Gore, now global warming has entered the debate in the public square. Now people are talking about it. It's nothing new, obviously. I remember when I was going to school back in the early 80s, my professors used to talk about this subject matter a lot. But for whatever reason, in the public square, this debate did not take place until very recently. Unfortunately, our country, the U.S., is the largest contributor to global warming, as you know. According to estimates by the World Resource Institute, on per capita basis, the carbon dioxide released by American citizens stands at about 20 metric tons per year on per capita basis. Now, in comparison, China's rate is 2.2. That tells you the disparity. The bad news is that probably sometime next year, China will surpass the U.S. in terms of the total carbon dioxide emission, which is very bad news, actually, with the large population base that China has. Deforestation is another great threat to the world environment. As you know, forests are being cleared at an alarming rate around the world, particularly in the Amazon basin. One of the great sources of clean air and oxygen in the world are obviously forests. In the Amazon, for decades, jungles are cleared for commercial development to create pasture for cattle and to plant soy products. Unfortunately, much of the Amazon rainforest is gone. Actually, it was in the news last week or the week before that satellite images showed that over the past 3-4 months, some 6,000 square miles of rainforest has been cleared in the Amazon rainforest. So it's not slowing down. And as you know, trees produce oxygen and absorb carbon dioxide, right? So when we lose trees, we lose these good agents that can provide a good service to us. Another important side effect of deforestation is losing biodiversity. When we clear jungles and forests, we lose biodiversity. Let me talk about that for a sec because this is very critical. Extinction, as you know, is a normal process in the course of evolution. Species have gradually evolved. Some of them have disappeared because of climate changes and lack of adaptivity to emerging circumstances, right? This has always been the case. However, since the 1600s, with the dawn of modernity, the rate of extinction has accelerated dramatically because of human activity. Primarily because of immense growth in the rate of population growth. Did you know that when we entered the 20th century, there were roughly about 1.6 billion people? When we left the 20th century, the population size was 6.1 billion people. So in a span of less than 100 years, we added something like 5 billion people to this planet. And obviously, the more people you have around, There is going to be more competition with plants and animals and so forth with regard to resources. Many biologists believe that right now we are in the middle of the greatest mass extinction episode since the disappearance of dinosaurs some 65 million years ago. Every year, thousands of species die away before biologists can even identify them. Let me give you any statistics here. Over 8,300 plant species and 7,200 animal species around the world are threatened with extinction. In all likelihood, within the next 30 years, they will all be gone. Now, biodiversity is not just a nicety. It's not that just, you know, we go to zoos and we see all these beautiful plants and animals. Biodiversity is very critical to ecosystems. What is an ecosystem? An ecosystem is a community of plants, animals, their habitats, and their surroundings, right? Can you think of some examples of ecosystems? Forests. Forests are ecosystems. Coral reefs in the ocean are another ecosystem. Wetlands are also ecosystems. The problem is when some species disappear, then their disappearance may irreversibly damage the ecosystem and lead to their decline. See, we humans sit on top of the food chain, right? It's not always a good thing to sit on top. We are on top of the pyramid. When blocks are removed from inside the pyramid, the whole structure may collapse. And this is exactly the predicament that we are facing. I hope I don't sound alarmist to you, but this is true. This is the crisis that humanity is facing. As I mentioned, it seems like the modern civilization is at war with nature. As stupid as it may sound, we are destroying the very nature that sustains us. We are putting at risk the very ecosystems that sustain our life. This is the problem at its core. We are doing injustice to nature. So, it is the teaching of Islam, and for that matter, the teaching of all great religions of the world, to be just with nature. We need to reverse course. We need to change our perspective of nature. You see, those of you who are familiar with the Holy Quran, every single element in nature is a symbol of God, an ayah. It is sacred. It is not for us to destroy them, to disrespect them. You see, the fact that we are destroying nature is because we think that nature is inert. It has no life. It's because we have turned our back to the great insights of all world religions. We need to stop that. We need to stop the great injustices we have done to nature. Now let me turn to personal justice. Personal justice obviously deals with the individual, right? Justice as it relates to individuals. Islam's holy book, the Quran, is very keen on nurturing a sense of justice in its followers. Again, this is not to say that Muslims always abide by these principles, but nonetheless is one of the aspirations of Islam, to instill a sense of justice in its followers. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْمُرُ بِالْعَدْلِ. God commands justice. This exact phrase is mentioned repeatedly in the Holy Quran, over and over, to show the importance that justice has in Islamic mentality. What is personal justice? Well, personal justice is about fairness, to be fair. It is about not being selfish and trample over others to get ahead. It's about not having double standards. So whenever we're talking about personal justice, all three things must be in mind. Fairness, lack of selfishness, as well as not having double standards. The Quran offers concrete guidelines to Muslims for justice. Let me give you a sampling of these Quranic commandments with regard to personal justice, justice at the individual level. Chapter 4, verse 58. Again, this is the challenge to all Muslims. This is the way they are supposed to live. God commands you to return things entrusted to you to their rightful owners. And if you judge between people, to do so with justice. God's instructions to you are excellent, for He hears and sees everything. In other words, when you judge between people, do it justly. It's a commandment to be fair, to be even-handed when we judge between parties. We should not give any consideration to friendship when we judge. We should give no consideration to power, to social status of the people we are judging. No consideration at all. Say it as you see it. This is the challenge that the Quran poses to us. Let me give you another Quranic commandment on personal justice. Chapter 5, verse 8. You who believe, be steadfast in your devotion to God and bear witness impartially. Do not let hatred of others lead you away from justice. Do not let your hatred of others lead you away from justice, but adhere to justice, for justice is closer to piety. Be mindful of God. God is well aware of all that you do. You see, it is fairly easy, or relatively easy, to be just with good people. It is relatively easy to be just to deserving people. But boy, it is very tough to be just with people who hate us. It is very difficult to be just with people who violate us, who attack us. It is very difficult to be just with our enemies. But that's precisely the challenge that the Holy Quran poses to us. To treat those who have ill will towards us with dignity and fairness. This is the challenge. Again, this is the yardstick for being a good Muslim. To be fair even with enemies. Another one, chapter 4, verse 135. You who believe, as you can tell, these verses start with a challenge. If you think you believe, if you think you have faith, this is the yardstick by which you have to live. You who believe, uphold justice and bear witness to God, even if it is against yourselves, your parents, or your close relatives. Whether the person is rich or poor, God can best take care of both. Refrain from following your own desire so you can act justly. If you distort or neglect justice, God is fully aware of what you do. Two important issues are discussed in this verse. Number one, the verse gives us an acid test to determine how much faith we have. Stand firm for justice if it does not serve your interest. Stand firm for justice even if it harms the interests of someone you love. That is the acid test for faith and being faithful. In other words, justice transcends familial relationships. Justice supersedes patriotic considerations. You see, that's the challenge. Many of us, when it comes to justice, would stop with patriotic considerations. And that's what where the problem starts. Quran invites humanity to be just without regard to nationality and patriotic considerations. This is the acid test. The second important point in this verse, if you notice, the verse creates a link between our capacity to act justly and our capacity to restrain our selfishness. You see, selfishness and justice do not mix. Selfishness and justice do not go together. Those who are tall on selfishness and egotism will always be short on justice. This is the rule. So those of us who really care to be just and to act justly, we need to do something about our enlarged ego. That is the message of the Quran. Since we are running out of time, I'm going to stop right here with regard to personal justice, and now I'm going to turn to social justice. So far, we've talked about justice with regard to nature and what happens when we do injustice to nature. Hell breaks loose. And the second topic was personal justice, how we should be just individually. Now let's talk about social justice as far as Islam is concerned. You see, personal justice is concerned with an individual's attitude and individual's actions. Social justice deals with institutions. Social justice deals with institutions, political, social, and economic institutions, how they operate. Social justice is concerned with the content of the laws and regulations that rule over society. That is the concern of social justice. Social justice is very crucial to Islamic thinking. So crucial, in fact, that the Quran states that one of the primary missions of all prophets and messengers of God was to invite humanity to uphold justice. This is very crucial. You see, all of us obviously want to know why Moses, Abraham, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, why did they appear amongst us? What was their goal? What was their mission? According to the Quran, one of the primary missions of all messengers of God was to invite us to uphold social justice. Let me give you the verse in the Quran. Chapter 57, verse 25. We sent our messengers with clear signs, the scripture and the balance, so that people could uphold justice. We also sent iron with its mighty strength and many uses for humankind. The best way to visualize what this verse is saying is to picture the statue of the blindfolded woman that you see in almost every courthouse. A blindfolded woman with a set of scales in one hand and a sword in the other one. That's the goddess of justice, right? And that's exactly what this verse has in mind. The book, the balance, and iron. These are metaphorically three things that hold a society together. And that was the mission of the prophets of God, to bring these three for us. The book metaphorically means the set of rules, the laws, the values, do's and don'ts that we should follow in our personal and social affairs. That is what is contained in the book. The balance is the scale, right? To judge in civil disputes. That scale should be used to judge our social policies. to see whether our policies, our laws are in line with our values and our principles. Lastly, iron is the strong arm of the law, right? All three must come together in order to have social justice. In other words, according to this verse in the Holy Quran, the social goal of the prophets was basically to invite humanity to create a community in which justice permeates the law, in which justice permeates politics and the economy, to establish a society where all social, political, and economic institutions embody justice. That was the mission of all the prophets of God. In fact, Islam's prophet Muhammad, when he started his movement in Arabia some 1400 years ago, he pursued two goals concurrently, simultaneously, side by side. The first goal of Islam's prophet was to deliver the word of God to humanity. And according to Muslim belief, the word of God is contained in the Holy Quran. So that was the first pillar of his mission. The second one was basically to create a model community, to create a model community that was characterized by practical compassion. This second aspect is very critical to Muslims. So the second pillar of Islam's prophet mission was to create a community that revolved around practical compassion. This second dimension of the prophet's mission was obviously very political. That's why politics is so important to Muslims. Politics has a religious significance in Islam. Politics has a religious significance in Islam. State affairs, political affairs, are not a distraction from spirituality. Rather, they are the stuff of religion. This doesn't mean, by the way, that Islam endorses theocracy. That is not the case. Theocracy does not exist in authentic Islam. Islam does not endorse religious government. Having said that, politics itself is of very important value to Muslims. Why? Because someone who is hungry, someone who has no roof over his head, someone who is sick and illiterate, when someone is constantly worried about bread and butter issues, spirituality, I submit to you, will be very low on his priorities. His main priority is to fill his stomach. That is why Islam demands that we fight to remove all the obstacles in the path of spirituality. I personally believe that spirituality comes after we are well fed, not beforehand. So it should go hand in hand. We should have a good material life as well as a very good spiritual life. This is actually the paradigm of Islamic thinking. In the West, a lot of scholars have a problem with the Islamic mindset, with the Muslim mindset. They don't understand why politics is so important to Muslims. Because politics is supposed to be a quote-unquote secular affair, as opposed to religious affairs. In Islam, this duality is non-existent. They always go hand in hand. The Quran puts a strong emphasis on protection of the vulnerable members of society. Those of you who've read the Quran, I'm sure you've seen the verses about protecting orphans, protection of the poor, the widows who don't have enough money to feed their kids. There are a lot of verses in the Quran dealing with that. There are verses in the Quran that chastise those who engage in usury. What is usury? Well, it used to be an awful practice, especially in the past, although we have some of it still going on, even probably in our own society here, where people charged an exuberant amount of interest on the money that they lent people, right? Islam abolished usury. There are even verses in the Quran that say that those who engage in usury declare war on God. That is how bad it is in Islam. Why? Because usury was an exploitative practice. Islam basically opposed that. What I'm trying to say is this. Practical compassion is a goal of Islam when it comes to social formations and social organizations. If we scratch the surface and go deeper into this discussion, social justice is really concerned about distribution of power. Distribution of power. Let me spend a few minutes talking about that, so we understand Islamic commandments better when it comes to social justice. What is power? Well, power at the minimum is composed of three elements: force, wealth, and knowledge. Force, wealth, and knowledge. These three correspond to political power, economic power, and intellectual power. All three are components of total power. Political power is obviously the capacity to rule, the capacity to command, the capacity to craft laws and then ask citizens to abide by them. See, IRS is a symbol of power. You don't have a choice when it comes to taxes. It is not an act of compassion on your part to pay Uncle Sam. It is the law. If you don't pay, you will face the strong arm of the law. That is brute force. I think it was Benjamin Franklin who correctly said that at its core, political power is brute force. He's absolutely right on that. That's what political force is all about. See, we have no choice when it comes to following the dictations of government. That's political power. Economic and financial power. Well, that means not only laying claims to goods and services in society. That's just a part of it, right? Those who have financial power can have more goods and services. There's more to economic power. It also means having the capacity to influence public debates, the capacity to influence the decision-making process, right? That's what the wealthy do in democracies. They find a way to translate their economic power into political power. Every single social system allows a mechanism for the people who have wealth to translate their economic might into political power. And thirdly, intellectual power. It means access to information. Those of you who've taken Philosophy 101, I'm sure you've heard of this saying of Aristotle. Knowledge is power. You remember that? Knowledge is power. In other words, people who have a great deal of access to information, they have a lot of power. So, whenever we talk about power, we're talking about these three components. Having said that, concentration of power, I submit to you, is not a good thing. Concentration of power is not a good thing. When political power is concentrated, what do we call that? What? Well, there is another term that I'm familiar with, tyranny. Tyranny is high concentration of power. When there is a great deal of concentration of economic power, we will have poverty. Poverty is one of the consequences of high concentration of wealth in society. Now, concentration of knowledge in the few means ignorance for the many. That's also bad. In all three areas, Islam advocates distribution of power. That is the Islamic motto, distribution of power, both in the realm of politics, economy, as well as knowledge. Tyranny, poverty, and ignorance, they are all symbols of social injustice. Let me go over a few of these ills that unfortunately pervades our society at home and also the larger international community. These are the challenges that we are facing in the new millennium. Poverty, unfortunately, is growing rapidly around the world. I know that some of you may subscribe to trickle-down economics. That's fine and dandy. But nonetheless, those of you who follow the statistics, poverty is growing at an alarming rate around the world. Poverty is not due to inadequate resources. Poverty is not due to insufficient resources. It is due to unfair distribution. At core, that's what poverty is all about. Some people incorrectly think that there are a lot of poor folks out there around the world because we don't have enough resources. That has nothing to do with poverty. It all has to do with distribution. It was Imam Ali who said, "I never saw wealth piled up somewhere unless poverty piled up somewhere else." In other words, mass wealth and mass poverty always, invariably, go hand in hand. There is absolutely no exception to this fundamental rule. As far as Islam is concerned, poverty is a symbol of failure of society. Whenever you see poverty in a society, it means that society has failed. There is another one, prisons. Prisons are basically a testament to the failure of a society in raising good citizens. There are actually sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that showed the extent of his disdain for poverty. And here is a prophet of God talking about poverty and how bad it is. Poverty is the next door neighbor of disbelief. That's one of the sayings of Islam's prophet. Poverty is the next door neighbor of disbelief. In other words, poverty and atheism are not that far apart. There's another one. When poverty enters one door, faith exits from the other. When poverty enters from one door, faith exits from the other. Don't get it wrong. Islam's prophet is not saying that financially poor people are inferior in the sight of God. It doesn't mean that God is partial towards the wealthy. It doesn't mean that on the day of resurrection, God will look at your financial statement and if you didn't make a whole lot of money, you're going to go to hell. That doesn't mean that. Essentially, what the prophet is saying is the following. When we are penniless, when we are hungry and poor, we are more prone to engage in unethical dealings to feed ourselves. That makes sense, right? When we are poor, we are more prone to lying and stealing and becoming foot soldiers for those who have money but no value. The global statistics on poverty is absolutely alarming. Let me give you some of these statistics about global poverty. According to the World Bank, in 2001, 1.1 billion people lived in extreme poverty. Do you know what the definition of extreme poverty is? Anybody? What does it mean, extreme poverty? Exactly. Less than $1 a day. Can you picture that? 1.1 billion people live on less than $1 a day. 2.7 billion people lived on less than $2 a day. That's not the worst part of it. We have also a category called ultra poor. I don't know, to be honest with you, what that means. Poor is all I can, you know, picture. Ultra poor. Some 162 million people around the world live on less than 50 cents a day. Brothers and sisters, that is the world in which we live. It's a shame for humanity. That is a failure. That is a monument to our collective failure as a race. Poverty is also a big problem here at home. According to the U.S. Census Bureau in 2002, 12% of our people lived below the official threshold of poverty. You know how many people that is? 34.6 million people are officially poor in our country, in the midst of the abundance that we have. 18% of our children live in poverty. You know how many kids are? 12.1 million kids are raised under poor conditions and circumstances. Just think of the future. 7.2 million families in our country live in poverty. That's one in every 10 families. 10% of families in our great nation live in poverty. Well, that's not all the bad news. Wealth disparity, wealth inequality is also on the rise everywhere in the world. The gap between the rich and the poor is widening everywhere in the world that you look. Let me give you some statistics about the home front in the U.S. In 2001, the top 1% of households, the upper class, owned almost 34% of the total wealth in our country. The top 1% owned almost 34% of the wealth. The next 19%, which is the class of managers, professionals, and small business owners, the next 19% had 51% of the total wealth. If you add these two figures, what do you get? The top 20% of folks in the U.S. own 84% of the wealth, leaving only 16% for the other 80% of the population. It's not only that these folks lay claim to more goods and services, they translate their economic power into political power, perpetuating this cycle of inequity in our country. Now, there are also statistics for wealth disparity around the world. I'm not going to get to it because we don't have enough time. You see, I think modern communication technologies magnify the negative impact of poverty around the world. Almost everybody around the world these days has TV or satellite or access to into the internet. The poor around the world every day see images of the successful folks. They see images of the wealthy folks. And they always compare their own lot in life with those who are very rich. In sociology, and also in economics, we have two concepts. The concept of absolute poverty and relative poverty. Relative poverty is a lot worse when it comes to social peace than absolute poverty. People who are absolutely poor would never stage a revolution. It is when people realize that they are poor relative to others that they're going to do something about their lot in life. See, these images basically create a lot of resentment, a lot of anger, a lot of hostility. I remember when the Iranian Revolution took place some 30 years ago, people who were part of the upper class, cronies of the old regime, were baffled with why Iranians staged a revolution. They said, oh my God, we have so much wealth now. We have a lot of roads, hospitals, universities. What else do the people want? Well, they were partially right. Iran on the day of revolution was far better than the previous generations, than Iran of 30, 40 years prior to that. It wasn't absolute poverty that led to revolution. It was relative poverty. When Iranians suddenly compared themselves with everybody else around the world, they said, we have so much wealth. Why is it that we are so underdeveloped relative to the rest of the world? I guess what I'm trying to get at is the following. The growing poverty around the world, the widening gap between the haves and haves not, will always lead to political violence, to instability and terrorism. I've said it here before, terrorists are not born, they are made. Terrorists are made by unpleasant social circumstances, circumstances of despair, of hopelessness, of poverty. Unfortunately, the social environment all over the world is a fertile ground for growing terrorists. Very fertile for growing terrorists. Let me talk about political injustice briefly and close the lecture. As far as Islam is concerned, the legitimacy of a government rests on justice. A government that is unjust is illegitimate. That's why Islam opposes tyranny under any guise. This is actually the Ashura season in the Islamic calendar. In the year 600 AD, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein, staged an uprising against the Islamic government of the time. The battle was in Karbala, which is in southern Iraq today. What was the motive? What was the justification for the uprising by Imam Hussein? The ruler of the time, whose name was Yazid, he was unjust. His government was repressive. You see, Yazid, the ruler of the time, was a Muslim. He ruled in the name of Islam. He ruled in the name of the tradition of the Islam's prophet. Yazid, the ruler of the time, did not oppose using Islamic law or Sharia in courts. He wasn't opposed to that. The problem was that ruler, even though he was a Muslim, he was unjust, he was repressive. He didn't rule with the consent of the people. He didn't rule by the will of the people. In other words, from a purely Islamic perspective, his government lacked legitimacy. Now, going by that standard, many governments are illegitimate in Islamic countries today. If you go around the world, the majority of Islamic governments are definitely illegitimate because they are repressive, because they are unjust. Today, democracy and respect for human rights, respect for civil rights, are hallmarks of social justice. Any government that does not respect genuine democracy, any government that does not respect human rights and the civil rights of its citizens is illegitimate as far as Islam is concerned. Now, the repressive governments in the Islamic world should probably heed this wisdom in the saying of the Prophet Muhammad, "Al-mulku yabqa ma'al-kufr wa la yabqa ma'al-dhulm." So beautiful. A state can survive with disbelief and atheism, but no state can survive with tyranny. No tyrannical government will ever survive. However, a government filled with atheists, if just, can survive. But a government with a lot of people who pray day in and day out, but they are unjust in their social and economic institutions, that government will not survive. That is the teaching of Islam's Prophet. Unfortunately, it is very sad that governments in the Islamic world do not heed this wisdom of Prophet Muhammad. One last thing, and I promise it's going to be the very last thing that I'm going to talk about tonight. Justice and peace. There is another dimension to social justice which is very important. Unfortunately, especially in the U.S., we do not pay enough attention to it. Islam creates a link between peace and justice. There is a verse in the Holy Quran that elaborates on this. Chapter 49, verse 9. If two groups of believers fight, you should try to reconcile them. If one of them is oppressing the other, fight the oppressors until they submit to God's commands. Then make peace between them with justice, and be fair and even-handed, for God loves those who are fair and just. This is the teaching of the Quran. There is a link between peace and justice. There will never, ever be peace without justice. Without justice, peace will not be sustainable. According to this verse, when two parties fight, if we impose a solution on them that is unjust, we may have peace for a short time, but very soon hostilities will commence. If there is not justice, peace is not sustainable. Let me talk about current state of affairs around the world with regards to peace and security. Occupied Palestinian territories, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Caucasus, they are all witnessing a great deal of violence. There is a great deal of terror in those countries and other Muslim countries around the world. There are daily killings and atrocities. There is no peace in those countries. There is no peace, not because people living in those countries have defective genes. Unfortunately, sometimes when I read these superficial political analyses in our media, I get the impression that some people in this country think those guys in Iraq, in Pakistan, and Afghanistan are killing themselves because they have defective genes. They are idiots. They are stupid. It's not because of that. There is no peace in those countries, not because the religion in those countries teach their people to go and kill themselves, blow themselves up, and be violent. None of that. There is no peace in those countries because there is no justice. There is no peace in those countries because there is no justice. Until The grievances of people in those countries are heard and addressed, there will be no peace. And unfortunately, the scale of violence around the world is on the increase. It is a shame that in the 21st century, we are probing the outer space when we are sending unmanned vehicles to Mars and behind. We cannot get along on planet Earth. It is a disgrace to humanity. The condition in the Palestinian territories is absolutely appalling. Palestinians have been subjected to cruelty and daily humiliation for the past 50 years. No human being should be forced to live under such indignity and violence. To be honest with you, sometimes I get the impression that in the West, we grant more rights to animals than the rights that Palestinians have in their occupied land today. If animals are subjected to that kind of behavior, we would call it in this country animal cruelty. We will arrest those people and put them in jail. Peace and justice are intertwined. We should stop having these fake conferences on Middle Eastern peace. These endless and sham gatherings on peace in the Middle East, they're not going to get anywhere. Peace and justice are intertwined. There will be no peace in the Holy Land until there is justice for all its inhabitants, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. There should be justice for all of them in the Holy Land. And until we have justice there, unfortunately, there will not be any peace. Let me make a few concluding remarks and close my lecture. Justice has been a human ideal since the dawn of civilization. Unfortunately, that ideal has eluded us thus far. In the new millennium, we are facing challenges that are all rooted in human injustices. Injustice against nature has created environmental crises that basically threaten life on this planet as we know it. Social injustice has created vast poverty, vast repression, and gross violations of human rights all around the world. These injustices fuel terrorism. These injustices create unending cycles of violence and vengeance. The struggle for justice must continue here at home and abroad, because the survival of our planet and the survival of our human race depends on this struggle for social justice. We should do our best to strive in building a world that is socially just and ecologically sustainable. This is the mission, I think, for humanity going forward. I apologize if I went over time again tonight. I appreciate your coming here and patiently paying attention to my lecture, and God bless all of you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.